This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. And this sound is the wake-up call that's heard just before dawn every morning before a mosque plays the call to prayer. VPR reporter Nina Keck recorded this from the balcony of her hotel room in Amman, Jordan. While the city was still quiet, the call to prayer echoed off of nearby buildings and through the streets. VPR's reporting project in Amman was designed to tell the stories of Syrian refugees who were going to be resettled in the United States in places like Rutland, where the arrival of refugees was debated for months. But just as Keck was preparing to leave for Jordan to report on the Syrian refugee crisis, the story took a dramatic turn. The president announced his executive order temporarily halting all refugee resettlement in the United States. Keck has been reporting on reaction to the policy and the circumstances of refugees caught in limbo. You can read the stories, listen to them, and look at the photos all at vpr.net. Nina is now back in Vermont, and she joins us from our studio today to take us behind the scenes of her reporting on Syrian refugees. Nina, welcome back. It's nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be with you, Jane.
Before you actually left for Jordan, we asked VPR listeners to submit questions about the refugee crisis and how resettlement works and what they were hoping you might be able to help answer on your trip. And we're going to answer some of their questions today in our conversation. And listeners, if you have more, you can share your questions, your thoughts with us. Call 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. One theme that several listeners hit on is the security of how do we know who refugees are, if they're actually people who could pose a threat to us? What is this vetting process? Carrie asks, what is the vetting and application process for refugees coming to the U.S.? How long does it take? How common is it to be denied entry? Don wants to know, what are the vetting questions and circumstances for eligibility to immigrate to the USA? And Robert requested just a factual description of the situation there and an explanation of the process through which the refugees are cleared for entry. So, Nina, there are several million displaced Syrians across the Middle East and Mediterranean. So can you first of all just describe how officials know who these refugees are and where they are?
Well, the situation in Jordan where I was, maybe I can use that as an example. In Jordan, 655,000 Syrian refugees have fled into that country, which is just south of Syria. And that's been since the civil war broke out in the spring of 2011. And the first thing that happens is the UNHCR, that's the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, they're the main refugee agency for the UN, they register individuals who are crossing the border and make sure they're actually refugees versus someone who might be an economic migrant. And, you know, people coming across the border saying their house has been bombed typically qualifies as a refugee. I spoke to Douglas DeSalvo. He's a senior protection officer for the UNHCR in Jordan about this question to kind of explain it. And this is what he had to say.
Here in Jordan, we have a very robust security mechanisms. We have strong security agencies. There's a lot of information available on people from the moment they enter in from Syria to Jordan. Biometrics are taken, iris scans of fingerprints, and photographs at every stage along the way. So those systems now allow us to be confident and track individuals through our system at a level that was simply not possible before technology became available.
All right. So again, that's Douglas DeSalvo with UNHCR. Nina, can you talk a little bit about what the process is for deciding which country a refugee might be sent to for resettlement?
Yeah, that was a big question I had. You know, who gets to go to Germany versus Sweden? And the UNHCR knows from experience which countries offer certain services that might be very specific. So, for instance, if you have a refugee with an expensive medical condition, there might be certain countries that are better for that person to go to. Or If your profile has been embraced by Sweden in the past and you may have a member of your language group or from your region there, that may be a reason for the UNHCR to think, oh, let's send that person to Sweden. So there are different synergies they look at. Countries also express very clear guidelines and parameters to UNHCR about who they're willing to consider. So, for instance, Douglas DeSalvo was explaining to me that a country might tell them, yes, we'll take 5,000 refugees, but we're not willing to take families that are larger than six people because housing may be difficult for them to find. So it really depends on the profile of the refugees, the parameters of the countries, and the UNHCR tries to kind of figure out all of those things. Also, if a refugee has family members in a certain country, that's a big reason. You know, they've got cousins in Germany. Okay, that makes sense. Or, you know, they've got people from their town that they know very well in Canada. That's another reason. But Douglas DeSalvo said the UNHCR process, again, is only the tip of the iceberg as far as vetting goes, because you had listeners kind of wondering what the process was. Mm-hmm. Douglas DeSalvo was saying the UNHCR folks do the first round of interviews. Once they hand over names of refugees to a separate country, those countries then pick up the investigation. And this is what Doug DeSalvo had to say about that.
The United States in particular has many security agencies involved in verifying right down to the day that refugee gets on the plane, and the last checks are made to ensure that right up to that point they are confident across all of the agencies that this is an individual who's been verified to be safe and not to pose risk factors and harms. And I think if we look back at 40 years of resettlement into the U.S., we have just an infinitesimal number of cases where resettled refugees were the source of security problems.
Actually, about 3 million refugees have been resettled in the U.S. since Congress passed the Refugee Act of 1980, which is what all of our protocols are based on. And, yeah, the number, I asked a number of agencies how many people have been charged with crimes or linked, and they say it's a tenth or a hundredth of 1%, really small number.
Carrie asked in her question as well, how common is it to be denied entry? I mean, if from your reporting, Nina, do you have a sense of if people are just sort of stuck in this process endlessly or if they're actually denied entry into another country?
They are. And it's almost like people compared it to winning the lottery. I think less than 2%, closer to 1% of the people that want to be resettled actually get resettled.
Is this just for Syrian refugees or around the world?
Boy, that's a good question. I think it's for around the world, which is surprising. But, you know, when I was looking at the Syrian refugee population, there were so many that said we'd really like to go somewhere, anywhere safe. And the reality is most of them will not. They'll stay in their country of shelter. Where I was, that was Jordan. And they've got to eke out a living however they can and hope that they can either stay in Jordan or be resettled back into Syria when things settle down there and things get rebuilt.
So they just wait and wait and wait in many cases and then hope that their country stabilizes?
Exactly. And most of them said that was the hardest part because they had really full, rich lives back in Syria. They talked about, you know, they had farms, they had businesses. One gentleman I spoke to was a police officer, you know, just like you'd find here. And suddenly that's all gone. It's like they've gone back in time a century and are living with a lot less. And nothing is in their control, which was really gut-wrenching.
So for the people that you spoke to, was there a sense of hoping that they could go back to Syria at some point, or just sort of having to let that go and say, this is my homeland, but it's not a place that I will ever call home again? I mean, what sense did you get?
I asked that question to just about every Syrian refugee family and individual that I met, and all of them said at some level they were hopeful, because I think if they gave that up, it would be too crushing. Many said they would, even though they were hopeful to move back at some point, they would still like to be resettled somewhere else for their children. That was the big theme that I heard over and over again. I can deal with this limbo, but I'd really like it for my children to be settled somewhere where they can get a good education. So that was hard. And there were some refugees that told me, you know, I can't even hope anymore. It's just too hard.
I'm talking with VPR's Nina Keck about her reporting trip to Jordan and what she learned about the lives of Syrian refugees. And listeners, if you have a question for her, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. And Nina, you just mentioned children. We got a question from Martha, who is hoping that you could talk about the scope of social efforts to minimize long-term effects on children.
That's a great question. And I was hoping to visit a school while I was in Amman, because Amman's population has just exploded. Jordan's population has just exploded. It's, I think, doubled since 2000 because of this refugee crisis. So schools are now working in double shifts, which is kind of crazy to think about. And I was thinking, they talk about 1 in 10 people in Jordan being from Syria. So it'd be like if 61,000 needy Canadians came into Vermont and just said, okay, help us. It's a huge issue. The person that you mentioned that was asking about kids, I think the Jordanian government is working pretty hard. They had a lot of non-governmental organizations doing various things to help. But as I said, the schools are strapped. They are working double shifts. So the Jordanian kids go to school in the morning segment, maybe from, 8 or 9 till noon. And then they have an afternoon section from 1 to 4 or 5 for the Syrian refugee kids. But not all of the Syrian refugee kids have access to a bus to get to the school. Not all of them just can actually physically afford the books and the fees and things like that, even though the school is free. So that's tough. There were some non-governmental organizations that had programs in the schools to provide help, counseling, nutrition guidance, so that teachers would be better equipped to deal with these needy kids. But I think it's just a gigantic problem, and Jordan's economy is really hurting right now, so it's tough.
One of the things that fascinated me in listening to and reading your reporting, Nina, was how various refugees are in very different kinds of living situations. And for me, that was a surprise, because when I think of refugees, I've always thought of refugees living in a very bordered community, a refugee camp. And sometimes you think of a tent city, for example, and in fact, in Jordan, some refugees do live in a camp, but many don't. Could you describe how refugees are living?
Yeah, that was a shock to me, too. When you think about Zaatari, that is the second largest refugee camp in the world, and it's just south of the Syrian border, I think 8 miles south of the Syrian border in northern Jordan. 80,000 refugees live there, and maybe 2 years ago, it had blown to, I think it had expanded to 130,000 refugees were living there. It was just very crowded. They opened another refugee camp, and actually several other refugee camps, to kind of spread out those folks. But the reality is only 10% of the Syrian refugees that have come into Jordan live in the refugee camps, which shocked me. So most of the folks are eking out a living in small apartments. I was in a number of them. Some are eking out a living as migrant workers. I met some farmers that were fascinating to me that live in tents on farmland, and they've worked out a deal with the Jordanian landowner to work the farms for day wages, and they don't pay to put their tents up. But if you can imagine that in 30 and 40 degree weather, it's not comfortable. The vast majority, 90% of the refugees from Syria in Jordan do not live in the camps. They're just doing the best they can wherever they can find shelter.
And even these camps, I mean, you described them, that there are actual buildings that have been erected. When the camp was first set up, it was tents, but now it's not. It's sort of like little mini tiny apartment blocks.
Yeah, they call them caravans, and I'm forgetting the dimensions, but if you can imagine a small rectangular corrugated metal building, there's no insulation. And the more kids you have, the more of these caravans you get. And they were explaining to me that the newer models have a small kitchen and toilet built in. They're slightly larger. But it's a great step up from the tent city that was first erected in 2012. That's when Zaatari first came up, or first was created, to just handle this wave of humanity. And it sounded like that was pretty depressing. I talked to a number of refugees in Zaatari that had been there for 4 years, and they well remembered living in the tents and how depressing it was. And now you just look at this sea of sort of beige colored rectangles, and many of them have tents that kind of create an extra living space patio, covered patio in between. It was pretty jaw dropping.
I want to just listen to a little bit of your reporting from Zaatari, the camp that you've been describing. And as you said, it's very close to the Syria-Jordan border. Let's just listen to a little bit of your story here.
Mohammed Alamit, a father of five, was a police officer back in Syria. He fled to Jordan after the Free Syrian Army kidnapped him and threatened to kill him if he stayed. The safety at the refugee camp is everything, he says. But he admits it's taken years to come to grips with living in limbo.
When we first came here, the situation was tragic. I came here on the 6th of November, 2012, and everything was tense. And I would sit by myself in the tent sometimes, and I would cry away from my family. But the situation starts to develop. It starts getting caravans and start having services. And thank God now the situation is not bad.
Welcome, welcome.
So that was Mohammed, the former police officer, and I so remember spending time. He invited me into his home so that I could meet his wife and five children. And I also wanted to see the inside of a shelter. And I was really flattered. He brought me into his home, which, you know, the street outside his dwelling was just solid mud. It was unbelievable, really. And I kept thinking, how do they keep their dwellings clean? Because when we walked in, it was immaculate. They had poured concrete in this sort of patio area. We took off our shoes and we went into one of the caravans, which had no furniture. They all had low, flat cushions along the floors where they could sleep at night and they also could entertain guests. So we went into their kind of living room caravan, sat down on the floor. His wife, who was so lovely, quietly brought in Turkish coffee in these teeny little cups and set them down. The kids all started watching as I took out my recording equipment, and they were silent. But, you know, I asked them questions about life in the camp, and, you know, his two-year-old daughter kind of sat on his lap, and he just looked at me and said, you know, it was really depressing when we first moved here, but he'd been kidnapped as a police officer. That's why he felt he needed to move, you know, to leave Syria. And he just said, having safety for my children, and this was something that they all told me, being able to sleep at night and knowing my kids are safe is worth it, even though we're living in limbo. But, you know, the wife took me into their kitchen, which was another caravan, and it had a small sort of a sink with one faucet. They did have access to cold water. But the floor was freezing. I mean, it was really chilly. They had portable propane heaters that we would sit around. And the woman, I was asking her about life in the camp, and she said, I really missed my appliances back in Syria, of course.
Yeah.
Dishwashers and washing machines. They had, you know, their laundry was hanging up, and she just kind of rolled her eyes, but she said, you know, God willing, we'll get back to that.
Nina, are people allowed to work while they're living in the camp or even while they're living in Jordan in general?
Yes. And actually, there's a new program in the camp called, I think it's Work for Cash. But because they have so many households, I think the camp administrator I spoke to said they have 6,000 or 7,000 jobs that they have identified in the camp that they will pay Syrians to do. But there are so many more people willing to do them, so they rotate. So you maybe do the job for 6 months, get the cash, and then you have to rotate and let somebody else do that job.
So how do people make a living or sustain themselves? They're getting some money from the UN?
They are getting some money from the UN, and it's based on how many members of your family. And it's shrinking because budgets are tightening up. So the amount of aid they're getting is less. But they are able to work. And I'm forgetting what they were paid an hour. It seemed to me it was about $12.70 an hour. So it's not a bad wage. But things are more expensive in the camp. They have a couple grocery stores. And the Syrian refugees I was talking to said they run out of food. The food is more expensive in the camp than it is at a grocery store somewhere else. And so there's this double-edged sword. Outside the camp, the families that I spoke to who'd been living in Amman for 3 or 4 years said initially they were not allowed to work. So they were working kind of on, you know,
illegal.
Exactly, illegally. But just in this past year, I'm forgetting when, in 2016, the government in Jordan passed some laws that allowed Syrian refugees to work I think, limited hours and in limited capacities. And you had to get a permit, which is free, but it would be like for construction or food preparation, you know, food service jobs, entry-level jobs. Like if you had a law degree in Syria or a medical degree or a professor, that you couldn't do that in Jordan.
Or like Mohammed, who was a policeman in Syria, couldn't be a policeman in Jordan.
No.
We're talking today with Nina Keck. She just returned from a reporting trip to Jordan, and we're learning a little bit about the people that she talked to and what life is like for Syrian refugees in Jordan. We're going to talk a little bit more about the politics here in the United States and how that affected both Nina's trip, but also what is happening with refugees in Jordan when we come back. And if you have a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or share your comments on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. A musician plays a stringed instrument called an oud on the busy streets of Amman, Jordan. It's one of the scenes that colored the reporting experience of VPR's Nina Keck, who was in Jordan recently to cover the Syrian refugee crisis there. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're talking with Nina today to learn more about the Syrian refugees who are waiting for resettlement, possibly in the United States, possibly in places like Rutland, Vermont. If you have a question for Nina or an experience to share, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can share your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Nina, can you back up just for a moment and explain a little bit about why VPR wanted to send a reporter to Jordan in the first place?
Yeah, it's a big leap. It's a question. Back in the fall, when we were covering the resettlement plans in Rutland, people started talking about, I was talking with other journalists, and the idea came up about, wouldn't it be amazing to be able to travel to Jordan, where, you know, Zaatari refugee camp and so many Syrian refugees are, and try to meet some of the families before they come to Vermont. I think it was a little naive on our part, but that was our thought process. Wouldn't it be interesting to follow a family and also explain to listeners what it's like for these folks before they're resettled, to paint a little bit more of a nuanced picture? Because right now, you know, when you think about it, it's so much, they're statistics. It's hard to fathom. And so that was the thought process. And then when we started asking for, you know, questions from listeners, there were a lot of nuts and bolts questions like, well, how does this vetting work? How is it, you know, who comes to the U.S., who goes to Canada, like we've talked about earlier? There were just a lot of process questions, also medical screening questions. Folks in Rutland had a lot of concerns about what if these refugees bring, you know, diseases? How are they medically screened? So in being able to go overseas to Jordan, we thought, well, we could answer those questions. Plus, Jordan is a stable, safe country, and we thought that would be a safe place for us to go as opposed to Turkey, which is not right now, and Iraq obviously not.
So this trip was planned, but then just as you were getting set to leave, the executive order on immigration and refugees and the ban on refugees came down. So that must have colored the trip in a major way.
The floor dropped out. Well, and it was really frustrating because we'd been working with the State Department and actually postponed our trip by 2 weeks. This was sort of the infuriating part. We were supposed to leave January 14th and spend about 10 days. And the State Department had been working with us, and they said, you know what, you really need to work with this particular woman in Amman. She's the head of our refugee program. She's going to be out of the country right then. So if you can postpone your trip by 2 weeks, she'll be able to work with you, set up a lot of interviews, and give us an inside look at the nuts and bolts issues, you know, the classes, for instance, that refugees take on what it's like to be American and all of that. We really wanted to record some of that. So Thursday, before I left, the rumors were flying about what President Trump was or was not going to do with the executive order, and the State Department sent us an email saying, sorry, we can't work with you anymore. So that was really crazy, and you know, it almost called into question, should we go or not? You know, mm-hmm. Should we still go? Is this still a Vermont Public Radio story, or do we let the international media cover it? And I think we felt that it was still worthwhile. But my reporting definitely changed because one of our key support groups, the person that was going to help me and provide so much access, suddenly slammed the door. And so when I went over there, luckily my interpreter fixer, Ihab Mutasaud, was wonderful. He had some contacts. We had this interview set up with the UNHCR, Douglas DeSalvo. He was helpful, and we just kind of – I flew by the seat of my pants and figured that, well, if I can't tell the nuts and bolts issues as thoroughly as I was hoping, I can at least meet the people that are being affected and try to report on who these people are.
Well, and in fact, you did talk to some refugees about what they were thinking hearing about the executive order.
Well, right. One person that I spoke to was a Syrian refugee named Mohammed Al-Hafa. He said the bombings and the warfare in Damascus got to be too much. So he and his wife and their five children fled to Jordan 4 years ago. I spoke to him at an interesting apartment complex, a high-rise apartment in Amman. There were a number of Syrian refugee families there. He said he'd been pretty far in the interview process towards coming to the United States. It wasn't a done deal, but he was very excited, and they were hoping that it would come through until news came of the president's executive order. So here's Mohammed Al-Hafez.
We got destroyed mentally, myself and my kids. We went down to the ground. There is no more hope at all. There's a lot of people got destroyed. Some people, they were ready to leave. They sold their furniture. They turned in their apartment. And all of a sudden, they get a call from the UN saying that things have stopped. These guys got traumatized big time.
And again, that was a gentleman that I spoke to, a Syrian refugee. And you could hear the kids playing behind him. Mm-hmm. I was very close to an alleyway where there were about, I don't know, six or eight kids. And the alleyway was kind of, there was a lot of trash in it, but they were having a blast playing pickup soccer. And, you know, and that was something that I saw all the time. You'd hear these heartbreaking stories, and then you'd see the kids playing, and you'd think, wow, these kids are just caught in the middle. It was really touching.
Nina, you mentioned that you had a fixer and that this gentleman was really essential in helping get you access to families and to refugees and to people, because what you had planned to do was sort of shot by the executive order. So maybe you can tell us a little bit more about what a fixer does and then how you did talk to families, what that access level was like.
Yeah, my fixer, and don't you love, I love the name fixer, because he really was. He just fixed everything for me. A fixer is someone that a foreign correspondent will use. You know, if you're dropped into a foreign country and you don't know the language and you don't know the culture and you don't know how to drive around town, you hire someone to be your guide. And in journalism business, they're called fixers. We found Ihab sort of, you know, through a network of a friend told a friend told a friend. And I think that's how it works. But he was wonderful. And he'd worked with the New York Times. He'd worked with reporters from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He'd worked from reporters from Paris, all over the world. And he helped me with access, because it's interesting. He actually spent 20 years in the United States. He has his U.S. citizenship, lived in California, but moved back to Jordan and was a tour guide operator, but found once the Syrian crisis broke, it was more lucrative for him to work with journalists. And he was incredibly knowledgeable, and the Syrian refugee crisis was sort of his specialty. And so he knew a lot of Syrian families. He was very helpful. Like at that apartment complex, he said, let's go here. There are a lot of folks. And they walked right up to him and started greeting him.
So they knew him?
One of them knew him, and then he just sort of got the word out. And within, I'd say, 5 or 10 minutes, there were two families that had come down to talk to me. It was really wonderful. And he would translate for me. He drove me all over the city. And my phone, my Verizon phone plan, didn't work in Jordan, and I didn't have time to get a burner phone or change it. So Ihab just took all my calls, and he became like, I don't know, my girl Friday or whatever that, you know, he was like my right-hand person. It was really great. So he became sort of the focal point for me. And then I said, you know, can you get me, I'd like to visit a school. That was something on our plan, but unfortunately they were on break, semester break, so I couldn't do that. So, you know, you just kind of roll with it and say, well, what about this? What about this? And so he helped me a lot. One thing that was interesting, though, being a man as an interpreter, I did find it difficult with him to interview wives and women, like at the Zaatari camp. Women were much more reticent to talk to me. It was much more difficult. They would not allow me to take their photograph. And the same at this apartment complex. I talked to the fathers, and I didn't see any of the wives.
So I remember from emails that you were feeling very nervous, actually, when you and Ihab parted ways, because you thought, what am I going to do without my fixer? But then you got a female interpreter, and that changed things for you.
Changed everything. And this woman was working with a film crew, and so they let me kind of piggyback with them, which was really nice. And they had some fascinating interviews lined up that they allowed me to come along, the farmers that I interviewed that were so fascinating, and also some women who were living and working in Amman. One was a single mother. Her husband had died. The other woman, Kaukab, was a 27-year-old who had two children, and she was a hairdresser. She'd been a hairdresser in Syria. And, you know, she came back, or living in Jordan, she had to go to work, and she was working illegally. Said her husband worked in construction, but he couldn't get steady work. And she was fascinating. She opened up to me, let me take her photograph. And just having women in the room with my female interpreter, it changed everything. And so Kaukab, as I mentioned, was a 27-year-old mother of two. She had a 5-year-old son and a 2-year-old daughter. She worked as a hairdresser and had to flee Jordan, I think, back in 2013, and just talked about the stress and the tension of, you know, being forced to leave your homeland. Here's a little bit of what she had to say about that.
She said, like, if I'm in Sahab and the neighborhood nearby, it's getting bombed, you just start, like, you expect that you're going to also be bombed. You don't know if you're going to be actually attacked or not. So, and another example, she said that the men may leave and they would never come back, and that's what happened with her brother-in-law. He went to work and he لهلا مختفي. Until this day, they know nothing about him. They don't know if he's alive or dead.
Hearing that just gave me chills. And she said, you know, that the terror of leaving Syria and then just the uncertainty day to day of trying to make it in Jordan. Here she is just talking about the stress that she was kind of living under.
So I'm obliged to work because my husband doesn't have a continuous permanent job. So mostly I support him very much. And if it was for me, I mean, it's very overwhelming. And yesterday I came back, for example, at 7:30 p.m. and I have to be at the hairdresser. I have to take care of my home. And it's so exhausting, and I'm getting tired of this, but I have to because my husband's job is not stable, and yeah, we can't survive if I don't work.
Naina, it must be, I mean, the stress level of trying to forge a life in a place where there are so many unknowns and some stability, but so many restrictions also. You can just hear it in Kaukab's voice that there is this level of exhaustion.
Well, and her a friend of hers who was in the room with us, Alham, was another woman. She had been widowed. Her husband had been killed in a bombing. And the story that she told me gave me chills. She said that when she was back in Syria, the bombing struck. Her brothers-in-law went to retrieve her husband's body. They knew he'd been injured. They brought it back for her to see. And she was grieving. She's in shock. But at the same time, the loudspeakers were blaring. The regime was telling them they all had to leave. So she's grabbing her kids. And I asked her, I said, so you had to leave. You just learned your husband was dead. What did you take with you? And she said, well, I grabbed some cash that we had hidden. I grabbed family photos. And I grabbed the shirt that my husband was wearing that morning because he had taken it off. And she said, that's what I left with. And she said, it still smells like him. And I thought, wow, you know, and she's now working in Amman, supporting her kids. She's a school bus monitor. That's what she does to help make ends meet. But she also said it's exhausting and just yearning for her old life, missing her husband, and just trying to pick up the pieces.
Do you know what happens now to refugees who might have settled in Rutland?
The folks that are still waiting, I don't know. And I don't know if any might still be able to get in. That's the big question we were trying to find out. But I think everything is in such a state of flux. Maybe some more families might arrive, but I just don't know.
That's VPR's Nina Keck. Nina, thank you for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
You can find all of Nina's reporting from Jordan at vpr.net. Her trip was made possible by the VPR Journalism Fund. Coming up, two editors of their high school newspaper share why they just testified in front of the legislature in support of student press freedom. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Student newspapers in high school and colleges are often the proving ground for budding journalists. But in Vermont right now, there's a debate over how much freedom of the press applies to these young news gatherers. A bill being debated by the full Senate today in Montpelier would codify when and how school administrators are able to intervene in student news publications. Jake Bucci and Alexander Silberman are seniors at Burlington High School and co-editors of the school newspaper, The Register. They testified in front of the legislature last month, and I sat down with them yesterday to talk about their position. Jake Bucci kicked off our discussion by explaining how he sees the benefits of this bill, known as the New Voices legislation.
Something that gives students control of their own newspaper. It forbids administration teams in schools from editing the newspaper before it goes to print. So it really gives student journalists the opportunity to be journalists and to cover stories without fear of backlash from administration.
But the way I see New Voices and the way I see this law is after the Hazelwood ruling, it's really left a lot of discretion up to the principal and to the administration on what they can censor in a student publication. And so what New Voices does is it creates a set list, a definite list of what can and cannot be censored.
Do you feel like you have that freedom now within your school?
So currently we don't. We're under the policy of prior review, which means we have to send our paper to administration before it goes to press. So they could potentially take out things from the paper before the student body gets to see it.
Do you believe that that's not appropriate?
I don't believe it's appropriate. I believe there should be a certain level of respect, trust, and responsibility given to people who are 15, 16, 17, 18 years old. We do have two teachers working with us. This is part of a journalism course where we're taught the standard ethics and laws of journalism. Our teachers advise us on any controversial topics. This is not a free-for-all, just students printing whatever they'd like to print. We try and act like professional journalists, and we do a pretty good job most of the time.
So how often is the administration censoring or changing or prohibiting what's in the newspaper?
Well, so far, prior review is a new concept at Burlington High School. It was implemented in January of this year. And so far, nothing has been censored. However, over the years, self-censorship primarily has been an issue, where anything controversial, our advisor, who's our teacher, would bring to administration to see if they're okay with this, see if there would be potential pushback. And so a lot of content over the years has been omitted or pulled due to potential pushback we could receive.
Do you have any particular examples of that you
sure,
can share?
Sure, I do. This fall, there was a potentially racist sign that was brought into a Rice versus Burlington football game. And I believe the sign said 5 convicts, 4 gang members, 3 fathers.
And pointing to the other team.
It was a Rice student who brought the sign in, and it was directed at the Burlington team. And I reported on this, and I wrote a story about it. And given the subject and the controversy behind it, my teacher brought it to administration, to the principal, and they suggested that we did not run the image of the sign and that we did not include the article, what the sign said. And the way I see it, it's impossible to properly inform the public and for a member of the public or the community to have an informed opinion on this issue if they don't even know what the sign said in the first place.
So in other words, there was censorship, you believe, from the administration.
There was, but in that case, it was that whole process of self-censorship where my teacher brought it to administration. They said, no, we're not super positive with you running that. And so
took it out.
Yeah.
Jake, do you agree with what Alexander is saying about this this idea of the administration being able to influence coverage even if it's not actually officially sanctioned or censored?
I do agree with that. And I also think it's a dangerous precedent to set for our student journalists. In our class, we're teaching the journalists of tomorrow. We're teaching our generation of how to report on happenings. And in a time where good journalism is more important than ever, we should be teaching them that censorship in any form is not okay. And you should be able to publish the facts without fear of backlash. So this policy by administration of prior review, but also the ability for them to censor us, is really prohibiting us from teaching our students what the role of journalists and the importance of journalism.
You both testified before the legislature on this bill. I'm curious if you could tell us a little bit about what you said, Jake.
I really emphasized the point about the dangers of censorship and also the importance of, we are a student journalist, but when we step into that room every other day, I'm more of a journalist than a student. I take my responsibility as a journalist very seriously, and it's almost condescending to hear administration not trust us with this publication, to say that we might publish things just because, just to incite controversy, and that's completely not true. There needs to be trust from principals and administrations around the state that we take pride in our work and we really believe in what we do.
Alexander, what did you say?
I testified about a specific incident this December where I personally received pushback for an article that I reported on and published in the newspaper. It was an article about a specific student, and there was backlash from the student and also kind of some backlash from administration as a result of that piece. And so I talked about that situation.
It seems to me that you don't want to tell us about the situation itself. Is that because you can't for some reason?
Yeah, as part of it is we're worried about pushback. And that just goes back to why this bill is so important and why it's needed. Where I, as a student, I should have the freedom to learn and to explore and to write an article and not be silenced by administration and actually be able to discuss about it.
Some of the people who have testified, not in opposition to this bill, but who have raised concerns, have suggested that there should be perhaps a limit between total freedom of the student newspaper to publish without any kind of prior viewing from an administration, and maybe the ability for the administration of a school to say, we just want to be able to review for a certain few things to make sure that this publication is safe and falls within the standards of the school. And Nicole Mace of the School Boards Association brought up a couple of issues of wanting to make sure that a school could restrain the distribution of a student newspaper or any kind of student media if it met any of these four criteria: if the content was libelous or slanderous, if it constitutes an unwarranted invasion of privacy, violates federal or state law, or creates the imminent danger of inciting students to violate the law or school rules, or materially and substantially disrupt the orderly operation of a school. And I think that was actually Ken Page who created those four criteria that he was suggesting should be in the bill. Do you agree with those four criteria, that those should be reviewed before media is published?
I don't think they need to be reviewed. We're not just going out and publishing things in the newspaper that are inciting students to break rules. We have always followed the school guidelines with our school newspaper. And I believe, I might be mistaken on this, but the New Voices bill, you can't be libelous or slanderous in the newspaper. You cannot use profanity. There are still restrictions within the bill, so it's not a complete free-for-all. But
who would be determining that? Just the newspaper's editors?
I believe, I'm not 100% sure, but I think it would have to be a conversation with the advisors of the newspaper too, right? We have very smart advisors who guide us through the process, so it's not completely us.
The whole problem here is that so much is left up to the principal. With the Hazelwood ruling, basically anything that's against the educational mission of a school can be censored. So you can twist that and turn that in any direction. Anything can be censored. What New Voices does, it really creates a set of standards, specifically what can and cannot be censored. And to address those concerns of the school board, there's bullying and harassment laws that are in place and school and district policies that would supersede this law. There's privacy laws that would interact with this. Libel would not be allowed, and any other laws that are in place would apply.
So you're comfortable with somebody from the administration looking over the paper then to make sure that none of those things are happening?
I'm not comfortable with that because personally, and as a journalist, that just violates every standard of ethics, I believe to be true.
There is an argument, though, that says at least for most people who are working on a high school or even younger student media, that you're minors. You're not an adult yet. You're not expected to be an adult, and that part of the reason to have an advisor but also somebody who can check over the paper before it goes out is to protect you to protect young journalists who are, as you've said, learning the skills and learning the media, but you're not adults yet. You may need to have some protection so that what you're doing is actually following the guidelines. So why not have somebody who's able to review that before the paper goes out? Jake, I see you wanting to answer.
Yeah, I don't think we necessarily need protection. I think the more proper word would be guidance. We need our advisors who will still, who are adults, who are experienced in this process of, you know, telling us what we can and what we should publish. And going back to what Alexander said, it is still illegal for the Burlington Free Press to publish libel material, but the government does not screen that before it goes to print every day.
And to add on to that, we're working very closely with advisors, but the main problem at play is that decisions are being made without students being present when administration or the principal determines what content is there.
So you'd like to be involved if there was a question. Let's say your advisor says, Alexander, I'm concerned about this piece that you want to run. I'm worried that it may lead to some repercussions that we haven't anticipated or create some unease within the student body, and that's not within the guidelines that we want to have. I'd like to bring this to the principal. What would you like to happen in that situation?
Well, I'd rather discuss it with my advisor and have that be a conversation between us two rather than bringing the principal into play.
And if the advisor says, I don't think you should run this, who should the ultimate decision lie with?
I believe the ultimate decision should be with the editors.
So you're comfortable taking that on, you know, even if you, yeah, you're comfortable
yeah,
taking that
I
on.
I am. And once again, people need to keep in mind that these are student newspapers. These are student publications. The content isn't obscene most of the time. It's not crazy content. And students learn through making mistakes. If students don't have the opportunity to maybe run something that they shouldn't have run and face those repercussions, they're not going to learn what's okay and what's not okay to print in a newspaper.
Jake Bucci and Alexander Silberman are student editors of The Register, the Burlington High School paper. Thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
A new marijuana legalization bill moving in Montpelier would allow for personal possession. This is instead of a state-regulated system like Colorado's that was debated last year. We're going to talk about it tomorrow on the show, and you can send your thoughts to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.